immediately replied, "Yes, sir." King knelt on the street and prayed for the souls of the three civil rights workers. White locals jeered King, hurling insults and driving perilously close to demonstrators as law enforcement stood by and watched. Several skirmishes broke out between white thugs and protesters who defended themselves. Bands of white youth burst through parts of the march, pushing and shoving demonstrators, knocking down reporters, and breaking television cameras. Deputy Price refused to allow protesters access to the courthouse lawn, so King, joined this day by Ralph Abernathy, conducted a prayer service surrounded by hundreds of angry whites and 10 sheriff's deputies. King acknowledged the tension in the air. Amid boos and jeers, he noted Philadelphia as the site of the brutal murders 2 years earlier. "I believe in my heart that the murderers are somewhere around me at this moment," King remarked to murmurs of white approval. "I want you to know that we are not afraid," he said. "If they kill 3 of us, they will have to kill all of us." King's face poured with sweat as he received cheers from black marchers and heckling from an outer ring of whites. "I am not afraid of any man," he said. "Whether they lived in Birmingham or Boston, Mississippi or Michigan." "Hey, Luther," someone yelled from the outer ring. "Come up here alone and prove it." On Deputy Price's orders, whites tossed small fireworks near King, who continued amid thunderclaps that sounded like gunshots. Chaos interrupted his closing prayer. Rocks, bottles, and eggs were launched at demonstrators. The now shaken King watched in horror as disorder broke out. The Philadelphia terror, raw and insistent, affected King deeply.
"This is a terrible town, the worst I've seen," he relayed to reporters while leading demonstrators away from downtown back to the city's black community. "There is a complete reign of terror here."
The horror continued hours after he departed, as Philadelphia's black community defended itself from 4 separate shooting attacks from organized bands of white terrorists. The next day's New York Times front page featured King, in dark sunglasses, speaking with Deputy Price as Ralph Abernathy looked on. King sent a telegram to the White House asking for federal protection in Philadelphia that same day, explaining that civil rights leaders planned a second march. After Lyndon Johnson responded with a telegram expressing sympathy without action, organizers filed a lawsuit in district court for an order of protection. On Thursday, June 23rd, in Canton, Mississippi, King found himself in the middle of more racial violence. 3,000 demonstrators marched to the town, where they had a dispute with local authorities over putting up a tent at a black school. King and the protesters stood defiant.
"If necessary," remarked King, "we're willing to fill up all the jails in Mississippi."
Mississippi Highway Patrol fired tear gas and wielded nightsticks against individuals attempting to set up tents.
"This is the very state patrol that President Johnson said today would protect us," King shouted to a stunned crowd seeking refuge from the outbreak of police violence. "Anyone who will use gas bombs on women and children can't and won't protect anybody," he said, sounding more like Carmichael, who had been temporarily felled by gas.
Later, Carmichael tried to help in organizing a retreat.
"Don't make your stand here," he said at one point as he wandered through the chaos. "I just can't stand to see any more people get shot."
Unbeknownst to reporters, the White House had messaged King roughly 3 hours before the violence erupted, inviting him, Carmichael, and other major civil rights leaders to a secret parley with the president. King declined, aligning himself with a local movement rather than the diplomatic mission of the White House. As far as King was concerned, he and Johnson were long past the time for negotiations. King returned to Philadelphia the next day, this time accompanied by Carmichael. Television network camera crews traveled with bodyguards. White spectators threw eggs, bottles, and debris at the demonstrators. King, once more,
headed to the courthouse.
We are here once again to pay tribute to Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Cheney, he proclaimed.
Whites, some of whom had traveled from over 40 miles away to gain a glimpse of King, yelled out, "Suey! Suey!" in a mock rendition of a hog call meant as a derisive slur. King and Carmichael delivered competing speeches during the June 26 closing rally in Jackson, Mississippi, an event that captured long-running tensions between the SCLC and SNCC and reflected the movement's transition from a focus on political reform to a demand for more far-reaching institutional and structural change. Competing chants from SNCC organizers shouting, "Black Power!" and SCLC activists yelling, "Freedom Now!" marked the final day's walk from Tougaloo College to the Capitol building. King's staff distributed American flags, while Carmichael's surrogates passed out stickers featuring a snarling Black Panther. King preached a commitment to nonviolence to an audience that was beginning to lose faith in the combined powers of moral persuasion and massive protest. In a move that might have made Malcolm X smile, King confessed that his dream of multiracial democracy had turned into a nightmare for African Americans. Local people in Mississippi were no longer afraid, King observed. He marveled over the fact that thousands and thousands of Negroes have straightened their backs up. They realize that a man can't ride your back unless it's bent. He decried witnessing Blacks suffering from poverty amid a vast ocean of prosperity in other parts of the nation. Nonetheless, King continued to believe that even here in Mississippi, justice will come to all of God's children. He envisioned a new day, one where rat-infested slums would be relegated to history's dustbin, and the empty stomachs of Mississippi would be filled. He considered these words directly connected to the movement's future organizing, community building, and policy demands. A month spent shuttling between the White House, Chicago, and Mississippi had inspired in King a simmering indignation that had fueled his political speeches and organizing ambitions. The sporadic outbreaks of violence during the final days of the march worried King, as did Carmichael's penchant for grabbing headlines at the expense of what King considered the larger purpose of securing the passage of a pending civil rights bill designed to strengthen voting rights enforcement. Once firm ties to the White House diminished to the point that King now communicated with the president through reporters.
"I have heard nothing from President Johnson," King admitted to the press.
The White House demurred from any official position on the naked brutality by law enforcement in Canton, which had matched the terror witnessed in Selma just 15 months before. Malcolm X became the Black Power movement's avatar and intellectual North Star, a mesmerizing martyr who, depending on one's perspective, supported radical political self-determination, independent Black politics, third world socialism, an Africa-centered cultural renaissance, or some combination of all this and more. Carmichael projected Malcolm's inimitable combination of strength and vulnerability, passion for racial justice, and hunger to internationalize the Black freedom struggle. He also embraced Malcolm's critique of racial oppression's structural nature. While Malcolm's autobiography had made the political uniquely personal, Carmichael's book, Black Power, introduced the term institutional racism almost as an act of defiance against those who remained convinced that defeating racism simply required changing hearts and minds. Carmichael's envelope-pushing rhetoric knitted multiple parts of the movement into a powerfully cohesive argument for political revolution. He advocated Malcolm's self-defense posture, regaled audiences with popular seminars on the importance of Black history and the richness and beauty of African culture, and proved a vociferous enough critic of the Vietnam War to merit simultaneous investigations from the FBI, State Department, White House, and Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, the Magnolia State's version of the secret police. Black Power's arrival on the national scene coincided with King's campaign to end housing segregation and urban poverty in Chicago, a city ruled by the combined might of legendary Mayor Richard Daley and a ruthless local Democratic Party machine. King responded to the Black Power controversy by adopting what he considered to be the movement's virtues, while projecting nonviolence as the best strategy for the political struggles ahead. On July 10th, King spoke at Soldier Field to a crowd of more than 30,000 about the Chicago Freedom Movement and the larger Black liberation struggle. He fused aspects of Black nationalism and political self-determination with an unyielding commitment to peacefully disruptive protest.
"We must be proud of our race," King insisted. "We must not be ashamed of being Black. We must believe with all our hearts that Black is as beautiful as any other color."
King's words could be traced back to Malcolm X's emphasis on recognizing civil rights as a referendum on Black dignity. But King, like Malcolm after the Hajj, resisted the general denunciations of white racism that gripped portions of the Black movement, reminding those in attendance of the practical need for interracial coalitions and the sacred bond forged with white activists who risked their lives for Black citizenship. King lauded white Americans who cherished democratic principles above privilege, even as they became less visible in the public imagination the more that Black demands for justice increased. Black power hovered over the Chicago Freedom Movement, where late-night sessions with gang leaders produced temporary breakthroughs that faltered against the intransigence of a big-city political machine that King distrusted. Black power became an obsession among King's closest allies, most notably advisor Stanley Levison, whose ghost-written statement criticizing the movement appeared in the New York Times under King's name. The statement distanced King from the Black Power movement's historical origins in the political and religious organizing of Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, and Malcolm X, arguing that the call for political self-determination paradoxically revealed the weakness, rather than strength, of a Black community in crisis, a government in hiding, and a white majority experiencing its latest bout of racial fatigue. The statement betrayed a fundamental misreading of the most radical aspects of the Black freedom struggle, especially the forces bound to Malcolm X's legacy, an interpretation that King would subsequently correct in Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, his final book and most eloquently nuanced statement on Black power. King's movement for economic and racial justice wilted amid the combined heat of political and environmental elements that summer. Bursts of spontaneous civil disorder on Chicago's predominantly Black West Side produced fresh charges against King as a Pied Piper of violence disguised as a peace activist. The specter of white locals hurling bricks, rocks, and bottles at peaceful demonstrators in a northern city gave proof of Malcolm X's characterization of racism as a national illness not quarantined in the South. The white mobs angrily confronting open housing activists in Chicago neighborhoods and surrounding suburbs revealed new dimensions of Jim Crow, ones that supported Black radicals' demands for political power to finally break white supremacy's grip on Black life. On Wednesday, August 17th, King and Mayor Daley met with dozens of real estate, political, and civic leaders for an intense round of negotiations. The conversation settled on the need for more discussion, after both sides expressed open skepticism of the other's willingness to honor verbal pledges to open Chicago's housing for all Blacks in exchange for ending citywide demonstrations.
"Our humble marches have revealed a cancer," explained King, likening resistance against the movement to a patient accusing a doctor of causing, rather than discovering, a malignant tumor. "We haven't even practiced civil disobedience as a movement," he said, offering a candid prelude to the bold tactics he would shortly endorse in his efforts to end racism and poverty. Stokely Carmichael's emergence as a national political leader both energized and exasperated King. Carmichael's genuine intellectual curiosity lent gravitas to his increasing national profile, including an August 21st Meet the Press appearance alongside King and other civil rights leaders. Before a national audience, dressed in a suit and tie, Carmichael broke new political and rhetorical ground by placing Black power at the center of a swelling anti-war movement. Carmichael's quicksilver delivery reflected his itinerant young adulthood in Trinidad, the Bronx, and parts of the Deep South. He combined the thoughtfulness of an academic
with the rapid-fire delivery of a native New Yorker, massaged through a slight Caribbean lilt topped off by a southern drawl. Carmichael trekked where King couldn't before an audience unaware of Malcolm X's anti-Vietnam denunciations. Declaring the Vietnam War to be immoral proved to be the tip of the iceberg, as Carmichael explained to his interlocutors that he planned to urge every black man in this country not to fight in Vietnam. On the same program, appearing from a studio in Chicago, King praised nationwide protests as part of the solution to, rather than the instigator for, racial violence. At Chicago's Palmer House 6 days later, King and leaders of Chicago's civil rights movement accepted a written open housing settlement with city leaders and Mayor Daley. The largely symbolic agreement promised incremental progress toward residential integration, but lacked enough enforcement powers to be considered anything more than a face-saving measure for both sides. Black power hovered over the midterm elections of 1966. Racial fatigue over civil rights, desegregation, and urban riots formed a toxic brew that found Republicans winning significant congressional gains that foreshadowed the coming presidential election. The Voting Rights Act allowed federal registrars to spot-check counties that refused to comply with the legislation's elimination of poll taxes and other processes that restricted black access. Yet voter suppression and intimidation continued to thrive in parts of the South, especially in rural areas where local officials defied civil rights laws through threats of physical violence and economic reprisal. The Meredith March in Mississippi succeeded in registering thousands of new black voters, but many more remained unable to vote or unwilling to even try. Those who made it to the polls in 1966 found a climate that differed starkly from the feel-good election 2 years earlier, which had taken place in the shadow of the Kennedy assassination. Political realignment between the major parties openly hinged on the willingness to offer safe harbor to racists. Moderate Republicans, like Massachusetts senatorial candidate Edward Brooke, struck gold with lines touting, "A vote for me is a vote against Stokely Carmichael." Actor turned dashing conservative spokesman Ronald Reagan swamped incumbent Edmund Brown in California's gubernatorial race with a bracingly pugnacious campaign opposing civil rights, black radicalism, and Carmichael's frequent presence in the state. Lyndon Johnson privately blamed the Democratic Party's loss of 3 senators and 47 congressmen on a seemingly ungrateful core constituency. "I think the Negroes lost it," he told aides. Martin Luther King Jr.'s radicalization took public shape against the backdrop of the political triumph of the Voting Rights Act and the violence that engulfed Los Angeles less than a week later. The radical King linked the effectiveness of voting rights to the entrenched poverty and racial segregation that marked too many urban cities. Watts amplified King's efforts to turn the civil rights struggle into a human rights movement that expansively defined black citizenship and, in the process, reimagined American democracy. King's working alliance with the Johnson administration and white liberals frayed as the Vietnam War took increasing resources, energy, and commitment away from the movement for racial justice. As black power tapped into the unspoken anger, pain, and pride of black people across the nation, King deeply empathized with the movement's insistence on radical black citizenship, even as he disagreed with its supporters on goals, tactics, and strategies. King's radicalization in the 18 months after Malcolm X's assassination found him on the precipice of losing his faith in the vision of a black freedom struggle tied to civic democracy that had sustained him over the previous decade. He found a renewed purpose and amplified sense of mission by connecting the broad sweep of the struggle for black dignity with the individual humanity of the dispossessed from all racial and ethnic backgrounds, whose lives, he argued, not only mattered, but deserved a place of honor in the nation. King searched, with increasing fervor, to illustrate the universality of race, democracy, and citizenship through the particular lens of a black freedom movement that he remained convinced held the key not only to racial justice, but to an end to war, poverty, and violence in America and beyond.
Chapter 10. The Revolutionary King. On April 4th, 1967, a crowd of almost 4,000 gathered to hear Martin Luther King Jr. speak from the pulpit of New York City's Riverside Church. King denounced the Vietnam War in unequivocal terms.
"I come to this platform to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation," he explained early in the speech.
King's criticism of military escalation in Vietnam and the declining effectiveness of the war on poverty had severed his political alliance with President Lyndon Johnson. The Great Society's political shortcomings were now an unfolding moral disaster.
"The cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools."
Racial apartheid's grip on American democracy, argued King, corrupted the nation in war and peace, hurling large numbers of poor black and white soldiers toward a death march in international slaughter fields. King challenged America's moral and political authority to wage war in Vietnam by comparing the military's use of force overseas to the black youth throwing Molotov cocktails to wage rebellion in urban ghettos. Both used violence in service of larger ambitions that, King suggested, represented political and moral dead ends. Riverside marked King's transition from a civil rights leader into a political revolutionary. One who refused to remain quiet in the face of domestic and international crises. The speech represented the boldest political decision of his career. Despite King's proclaimed belief in the roots of American democracy, he publicly assailed the hypocrisy behind the country's posture as liberty's surest guardian around the world. In the months before his death, Malcolm X, too, had discussed the Vietnam War, marveling at how courageous peasants, with nothing but sneakers on and a rifle, were defying the world's greatest military power. But even as King decried America as pursuing a catastrophic trajectory rooted in greed, violence, and racism, he found optimism in the potential for democratic transformation. At Riverside, King assumed Malcolm's previous role as Black America's prosecuting attorney, publicly denouncing the war in Vietnam by offering a political seminar on American imperialism, racism, and economic injustice that announced his formal break with mainstream politics. In a preemptive strike against critics who would accuse him of confusing his civil rights leadership with foreign policy expertise, King cited Langston Hughes, the Black Bard of Harlem, explaining that, "America never was America to me."
"If America's soul becomes totally poisoned," reasoned King, "part of the autopsy must read Vietnam."
King was squarely confronting American political hubris by characterizing the Vietnam War as the nation's Achilles heel. He considered foreign policy analysis to be a substantive part of his role as a civil rights leader. Domestic and international struggles for justice and equality were never mutually exclusive, but, on the contrary, intimately connected in a manner that demanded forthright criticism. For King, America remained, at its best, a country filled with unrealized potential, as Hughes's poetry brilliantly evoked, but whose promise receded the further the nation strayed from its core values of liberty, freedom, and democracy. King characterized American soldiers in Vietnam as the victims of our nation and strange liberators who ravaged peaceful villages, killed innocents, and impoverished peasants. His anti-war criticism echoed and amplified Malcolm X's denunciations before his death, when he characterized Vietnam as the struggle of the whole Third World against Western imperialism. Like Malcolm X, King publicly wrestled with the grandeur and travails of American democracy. King confronted Johnson's intransigence on the war with a biting quote from his predecessor, the late John F. Kennedy.
"Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable."
Kennedy had spoken these words almost 5 years earlier,
during the wave of demonstrations, arrests, and violent reprisals that forced a sitting U.S. president to confront the nation's racial demons for the first time in a century. The stakes, now global in scope, had only escalated since Kennedy's time, introducing a precarious new era where the world seemed perpetually poised on a knife's edge of destruction. King's all-encompassing solution relied on what he called a revolution of values, led by Americans uneasy about growing economic inequality, ashamed of a bloody history of racial oppression, and embarrassed by a rush to war that tarnished a hard-earned post-war reputation as the guardian of the free world.
"War is not the answer," King pleaded, although the entire world appeared on the brink of revolutionary times.
King contextualized Marxism's global appeal in America's failure to embrace its democratic potential. In his new role as radical civil rights leader, King wielded both the rhetorical shield of his past and a political sword forged through the crucible of Watts, Black Power, Urban Rebellion, and Vietnam. Confronting the fierce urgency of now required new levels of moral and political courage, not only to defy the cruel manipulation of the poor, but to illuminate how racial segregation, urban poverty, and burning embers in Detroit and Hanoi were inextricably linked. King displayed a rueful awareness of institutional racism's contemporary power by naming my own government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Like Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and Black Power activists, King now defined violence expansively, finding a common denominator in the manner in which poverty, segregation, racism, and domestic and international violence converged in a discordant, jangling symphony of oppression. And yet, the beautiful struggle King outlined set him on a lonely political journey. After Riverside, one poll found that 73% of Americans disapproved of his Vietnam stance. 60% judged his peace efforts as hurting the movement. Members of the House Armed Services Committee counted themselves among King's most powerful detractors. Congressman L. Mendel Rivers of South Carolina and F. Edward Hebert of Louisiana led the charge in an effort to convince the Justice Department to punish King for supporting conscientious objectors against the draft, and Carmichael for turning "Hell no, we won't go" into a national anti-war chant. Higher education leaders followed suit, with the dean of the Notre Dame Law School attacking King and Carmichael as either communists or traitors who had betrayed the nation by opposing the war in Vietnam. King's call for peace included publicly advocating a universal ceasefire, a cessation of bombing, recognition of the National Liberation Front by the American government, and the removal of all foreign troops in Vietnam. Not even King's statesmanship could hide the fact that his speech at Riverside had brushed aside his long-standing strategic embrace of political reform. He now openly supported a human rights revolution that would turn America into a beacon of social justice and racial equality on a scale unimagined by the architects of the Great Society. But if Malcolm X had remained, until his death, eternally skeptical of American democracy's capacity to guarantee racial and economic justice, King maintained defiant faith in the capacity of massive civil disobedience to bend the will of presidents and political leaders. This faith inspired King to create new coalitions with the peace movement, new left radicals, and Black Power activists, all of whom found common ground in rejecting the Vietnam War as an example of American hubris, racism, and injustice. While critics labeled him politically reckless, King plotted a radical course, buoyed by his unyielding belief in the power of ordinary citizens to effect lasting social change. Large segments of America interpreted King's cry for peace as an act of war. Standing ovations received inside the friendly confines of Riverside were overwhelmed by the contempt of journalists, pundits, and politicians who viciously questioned his political judgment. The Johnson administration opted to ignore King, afraid that his anti-war remarks might spread across the spectrum of civil rights leadership. Ralph Bunche, the first African-American winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, who had verbally sparred with Malcolm X, now denounced King. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who almost a year earlier had forwarded the White House a report on potential racial unrest that cited 45 cities on the verge of rebellion, now furnished Lyndon Johnson with the text of King's Riverside speech, which threatened to damage the president far more than any race riots could. The FBI also furnished copies of its updated negative Martin Luther King Jr. dossier to the Attorney General, Secret Service, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense. The document argued that King's latest speech revealed him to be the tool of American communists. King's speech made front-page headlines, competing with the White House's announcement of plans to send doctors to Vietnam to investigate allegations of napalm being used indiscriminately against civilians by the American military, an effort to cauterize the festering national wound of Vietnam. After Riverside, King became America's most well-known anti-war activist, lending a Nobel Prize winner's moral currency to a peace movement struggling to find its voice in a political landscape where most Americans still supported the war. Riverside transformed King, who became emboldened by the diverse throngs of supporters, religious leaders, young people and the elderly, black and white, who gave him a standing ovation at the end of his hour-long speech, while facing soured political alliances and condemning press coverage. Media outlets that once lavished praise on King after his Nobel and civil rights victories in Birmingham and Selma now harshly criticized his strategic judgment and political temperament. Urban League leader Whitney Young publicly advocated keeping issues of war and racial justice separate, perfectly aligning with the White House's efforts to inoculate the larger civil rights struggle against King's anti-war talk. Edward Brooke, the first black man elected to the U.S. Senate in a general election, characterized King's Vietnam position as very costly because it sullied not only his reputation, but the entire movement. Barry Goldwater accused King of inflicting irreparable harm on the civil rights movement. The group, Jewish War Veterans, characterized King's Riverside address as an insult to the intelligence of all Americans, while his friend and longtime supporter, Jackie Robinson, offered the most diplomatic criticism. Dr. King has always been my favorite civil rights leader, but I don't agree with him on this issue. The New York Times termed the speech Dr. King's Error, citing it as a tragic misstep for civil rights and peace advocates that might prove disastrous for both causes. The paper criticized King's entree into anti-war activism as a distraction that sapped vital energies from racial hotspots in Chicago, Watts, and Harlem, suggesting that the moral issues of war were far from clear-cut. The paper attacked King for linking Vietnam and racial justice and blasted him for sowing deeper confusion in a country beset by growing polarization. Positive response came from old colleagues and friendly combatants. Stokely Carmichael embraced King's Vietnam address, which telescoped much of Black Power's critique of American democracy into a powerful call for peace. Critics now characterized King and Carmichael as two sides of the same political coin. King amplified his connection with Carmichael 11 days after Riverside, when they headlined the nation's largest anti-war demonstration in New York. On Saturday, April 15th, King delivered the keynote address at the Spring Mobilization to End the War in Vietnam. The Spring Mob, as activists dubbed the event, showcased the power of growing anti-war demonstrations, attracting a melange of radical activists, sometimes called the New Left, whose particular interests in women's liberation, environmental justice, labor activism, and civil rights were now galvanized around building a peace movement. 400,000 demonstrators marched from Central Park's Sheep Meadow to the United Nations, where King personally met with UN Undersecretary Ralph Bunche. King marched at the head of the demonstration, arm in arm with Stokely Carmichael, Harry Belafonte, James Bevel, and Dr. Benjamin Spock. The Spring Mob featured a series of firsts among demonstrators, including a group of Cornell University students who burned their draft cards in a coffee can during an impromptu ceremony. Stokely Carmichael dazzled the attendees with a speech that drew stark moral and political lines
between supporters and opponents of the Vietnam War. He relished trumpeting the domestic and international contours of a struggle against white supremacy that had led to this moment. As he spoke, supporters chanting Black Power could be heard in the distance. Carmichael praised King's anti-war position, noting that his Nobel Prize conferred a global acknowledgement of the connection between ending war and ending racism that still mystified American critics. "We will not support LBJ's racist war in Vietnam," said Carmichael. His speech mingled issues of race, power, and imperialism before the biggest audience he had ever addressed. King followed Carmichael with an oratory simmering with political indignation. That the two could share the same stage was all the more remarkable in light of the political tensions that grew after the Meredith March. Vietnam touched evils that transcended differences over strategy and tactics, yet King remained cautious. His call for the nation to stop the bombing, was tame in comparison to Carmichael's explicitly anti-imperialist rhetoric. King continued to walk a rhetorical tightrope the next morning during an interview on CBS's Face the Nation. He disavowed portions of the spring mob that desecrated the American flag, burned draft cards, and waved Viet Cong banners. He instead urged the peace movement to organize a massive education campaign and for all young men to explore the legal channel of conscientious objection. Civil rights and peace represented a double action program required by the force of history, observed King. He defended his appearance with Carmichael as part of a wider crusade against injustice. After citing their long history of working together in the Deep South, King went on the offensive, characterizing Black Power as a reaction to the failure of white power. He did not mention during the interview his private deliberations with advisors about appearing on stage with Carmichael, whom he knew scared the hell out of white folks. His decision to participate rested on his feeling that the anti-war movement required the widest possible coalition. Near the end of his appearance, King rediscovered his voice in a moment of shattering eloquence. The Great Society, he argued, represented the nation's most important war casualty, shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam. He repudiated the fantasy that America had enough guns and butter to satisfy domestic needs and foreign ambitions. "The heart of the nation is in Vietnam," he ruefully observed. "And where your heart is, there your money will go." King telephoned Carmichael just near midnight on Saturday, April 29th. With a surprise invitation to hear him preach. The invitation pleased the younger activist, who, rather than accept or decline the overture, investigated further. "Something special happening?" he asked. King replied affirmatively, telling Carmichael that, "Tomorrow, I'll be making my statement on the war." After a 30-second pause, Carmichael announced that he would be sitting in the front row of Ebenezer. On Sunday, April 30th, King delivered his definitive anti-war speech. He ridiculed the nation's selective acceptance of nonviolence, although he was widely praised for preaching the tactic in the face of racial terror in the South. Americans were overwhelmingly willing to curse you when you say be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children. King praised Muhammad Ali's controversial draft refusal as an act of moral witness. He spoke eloquently of Ali's sacrifice. "In order to stand up for what his conscience tells him is right," as if commenting on his own path. At the conclusion of King's sermon, Carmichael jumped up from the front row pew to lead a standing ovation, the third round of applause during the sermon, which recognized the transformation of King from a preacher and movement leader into a revolutionary. Carmichael could be exasperating, moving King to private complaints to advisors that the young Black Power leader was in over his head, and King's patrician bearing amplified an almost 13-year age gap. But Martin loved Stokely and treated him like a younger brother. They bonded over their shared reputation as charismatic orators, mischievous sense of humor, and unapologetic love for Black people. Now, King and Carmichael shared a message against the war abroad, for the sake of justice at home.
King's sermon at Ebenezer drew him closer still to the orbit of Black Power activists. In Atlanta, even more than at Riverside, King dramatically proclaimed that the madness of war, violence, and racism must end. His anti-war stance elicited support and admiration from Carmichael, but distanced him from Bayard Rustin, one of his closest former advisors. Rustin had read King's break from Lyndon Johnson as a strategic mistake. Aides to King, including Stanley Levison, urged him to be on your guard after Rustin publicly called upon him to re-examine his position on Vietnam and the civil rights struggle. King watched with dismay as Rustin, the pacifist who had snuck into Montgomery with wise counsel on the depth of nonviolence, now preferred to work within the system, through both the Democratic Party and Big Labor, which now funded him. Rustin, after years on the margins, had found a sinecure through the creation of the A. Philip Randolph Institute in 1965, a project backed by the AFL-CIO, blessed by his mentor Randolph, and constrained by dint of its mainstream financial backers from offering robust support to the anti-war movement. Lyndon Johnson, without ever mentioning King's name, responded to Riverside from the White House at a May 8th anti-poverty reception for 450 female volunteers. "No, we are not backing off from our commitment to fight poverty," Johnson asserted. "Nor will we, so long as I have anything to say about it." Unnamed critics who chided the government for spending too much or too little, or for abandoning the poor because of our commitment to the other war, were mistaken, Johnson argued. "We may never live to see an America without poverty," he admitted. "But we may see an America where a lifetime of poverty is not the inevitable fate of a child born into it." Johnson's passionate defense of his poverty program signaled that King, having courted open conflict with the President of the United States, continued to wield enough power to place the leader of the free world on the defensive. Private re-election polling judged that King might impact between a third to one-half of all Negro voters through his simple endorsement, meaning that Johnson's White House resisted public confrontation in favor of discrediting the Nobel Prize winner via surrogates. From Atlanta, before 500 people at a joint meeting of a local civil rights group and a black fraternity, King admitted to being terribly afraid we are moving toward World War III. He questioned the point of racial integration efforts' absent concern for the survival of the world that blacks were attempting to transform. He also denounced critics who claimed his anti-war stance mortally wounded the civil rights movement. "It is more alive today than ever before," he said defiantly, calling the epic battle to end legal Jim Crow a struggle for decency. He identified his focus on ending war, poverty, and racism as a new chapter in a struggle for genuine equality. King set out on a nationwide tour, displacing Carmichael as America's most well-known anti-war activist. Counter-demonstrators in Louisville, Kentucky, threw rocks at him during a speech campaigning for open housing. "Upon this rock," King declared, waving one of the stones, "we're going to build an open city, and the gates of injustice will not prevail against it." He promised to stir up trouble in cities plagued by rioting in hopes of proving that nonviolence remained the nation's most potent weapon of peace. King's linking of religious faith and political responsibility fueled a mission that improbably drew him closer to Black Power activists. King's public appearances now featured the kind of pugnacious repudiation of white supremacy that marked Malcolm X's persona, a fierce truth-telling that made him an even bigger draw on college campuses. The radical King stood tall during a speech at the University of California at Berkeley, where he told a crowd of 7,000 students, many holding King Spock signs urging him to challenge Lyndon Johnson in 1968, that the next phase of the civil rights movement would require a radical redistribution of economic and political power, a phrase met with echoing applause. He pushed back against white liberals who opposed racial segregation in Birmingham and Selma, but repudiated genuine equality for black Americans. King called white backlash a new name for an old phenomenon and indicted the nation for a policy of white supremacy that polluted its democratic aspirations and clouded hopes for black citizenship. Again, throughout the speech, King assumed the form of black America's martyred prosecuting attorney, Malcolm X, by meticulously delineating historic and present-day efforts.
"The fact is," King stated bluntly, "that America has been backlashing on the question of fundamental human rights for its black citizens for more than 300 years.
He linked racism and poverty to domestic riots based on unjust public policies and a war based on political immorality. He noted that, in the aftermath of the four girls martyred at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham 4 years earlier, there were no chance of black power, and yet the perpetrators of this vicious crime had yet to be found. King insisted,
"Black and white together, we shall overcome,"
even as he boldly repudiated white America for its failure to fully commit to racial justice. In an effort to illustrate the shared struggles of many Americans, King talked about the wide racial spectrum of poverty in America, where blacks, whites, Mexican Americans, and Native Americans suffered in abject misery in the bosom of the world's richest nation. The Johnson administration, King argued, seemed more concerned about
winning an unwinnable war in Vietnam than about winning the war against poverty right here at home.
The gigantic miscalculation of the war had only yielded a barren domestic crop of violence, dissidence, and recriminations. King blamed the war on the arrogance of American exceptionalism, the idea that the United States represented the world's singular moral, political, and economic power, a country content to perpetuate white colonialism rather than allow global peoples the right to self-governance.
"It's time to come home from Vietnam," King implored to thunderous applause.
He publicly endeavored to mobilize a peace bloc capable of challenging Johnson in the next presidential election, yet had no intention of personally heading such a third-party ticket. That summer, King published his latest book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, to mixed reviews. In the book, he studiously avoided demonizing black power, praising the movement's focus on black history, culture, and racial pride. Black power, according to King, grew out of a despair and hopelessness that made it rely on threats of violence that sapped its potential moral and political strength. Racial separatism ignored black people's need for coalitions strong enough to challenge forms of oppression that transcended race. King analyzed slave rebellions and urban riots as dual examples of the futility of violence in service of revolution.
"Fewer people have been killed in 10 years of nonviolent demonstrations across the South than were killed in one night of rioting in Watts," wrote King.
His book made no mention of Malcolm X, preferring instead to briefly analyze Frantz Fanon, the Martinican psychiatrist and Algerian war supporter whose book, The Wretched of the Earth, had become required reading among black power activists. King challenged black radicals to create the new society Fanon advocated without resorting to violence and brutality. Meanwhile, King's detractors refused to let up. In an article written in the FBI's Law Enforcement Bulletin, J. Edgar Hoover added to the chorus of criticism against King.
"To publicly pinpoint where riots and violence may occur," he said, "seems to be inconsistent with the doctrine of nonviolence."
If Birmingham, the March on Washington, and the Nobel Prize had elevated King to the status of royalty, his stances on Vietnam, race, and poverty were hurtling him toward a political reckoning that found him sharing common ground with Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and the Black Panthers. The Panthers imagined themselves the political heirs of Malcolm X. The Oakland, California-based group found inspiration in Malcolm's message of self-defense and anti-colonialism, took their name from SNCC's efforts to organize independent politics in Lowndes County, Alabama, and fashioned a revolutionary persona based on a 10-point program calling for a political revolution that necessitated grassroots organizing and guns. With reckless bravado,
the group legally surveilled the police arresting black motorists while armed and made national headlines by descending upon the California State Capitol on May 2, 1967, to protest an impending gun control bill designed to prevent them from brandishing weapons while observing the police. On the ABC program Issues and Answers, on the third Sunday in June, King spoke passionately about the black freedom struggle entering a new phase, one that required the government spending billions of dollars to eradicate poverty, ghettos, and segregation. While voting rights and public accommodations didn't cost the nation anything, black America now required a shared measure of sacrifice. Newly emboldened, King challenged Lyndon Johnson to embrace black political self-determination in terms that Malcolm X once framed, noting that African Americans were in the stage of self-assertive manhood, and there is no way for any president, no matter who he is, to avoid this problem. The next day, King amplified these radical sentiments, arguing to a national Today Show audience why it was necessary to disobey unjust laws because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as cooperation with good. While the press talked of long, hot summers of racial violence, King spoke of the long, cold winter of discontent when Congress and the president had ignored the conditions that create riots. Riot politics gripped the nation that summer. Black ghettos in Newark and Detroit exploded almost in unison during the second and third weeks in July. What black radicals called urban rebellions and conservatives decried as riots were most often triggered by escalating tensions between police and black residents. The conflicts were deeply rooted in poverty, unemployment, racial segregation, and neglect. After allegations of police brutality against a black taxi driver, Newark erupted just as local and national activists announced plans for a Black Power Conference, which would eventually take place in the wake of citywide violence that required the National Guard to quell. Leroy Jones, the poet and Black Arts Movement activist who deeply admired Malcolm X, received a brutal beating and arrest at the hands of police during the riot, which further radicalized him. Jones, who had changed his name to Amiri Baraka shortly after, became Newark's leading Black Power activist, organizing the Committee for Unified Newark, CFUN, that would help to elect the city's first black mayor just 3 years later. Baraka saw himself as embodying Malcolm X's radical call for political self-determination through community organizing that stressed racial unity, black dignity, and the relationship between Africa and black America. From the smoldering ashes of urban violence and racial segregation, Newark would become a case study in the local pursuit of black power. Detroit's violence, which dwarfed Newark's, began after a police raid on an illegal after-hours club, what authorities called a blind pig, on 12th Street. The arrest of 70 people only fueled neighborhood outrage, which grew violent enough for Lyndon Johnson to receive a 3 a.m. phone call from Attorney General Ramsey Clark on July 24th. Michigan Governor George Romney soon called the White House with news of widespread looting, pitched battles between bottle and rock-throwing residents and the police, and over 80 unattended fires raging across the city. The president huddled with advisors, including the young Assistant Attorney General Roger Wilkins, nephew of Roy, whom he dispatched from Washington to get a ground-level view of events. 2 days later, with the governor unable to quell the disturbance, President Johnson federalized the Michigan National Guard and sent in troops. Detroit's chaos left over 300 people injured and 43 dead. At least 1,200 people were detained in felony courts, the innocent along with the guilty. President Johnson, the most vocal supporter of racial justice in the federal government, argued during a nationally televised address that Detroit's violence had nothing to do with civil rights, while promising to restore order and punish lawbreakers. Racial violence in Newark and Detroit seemed to fulfill Malcolm X's predictions of race war and his skepticism about the ability of civil rights laws to guarantee black dignity. King was in the midst of a book tour for Where Do We Go From Here when the unrest began, and he held a press conference with reporters where he revealed the contents of a telegram he planned to send to the president. He challenged Johnson's interpretation of events in Detroit, noting that nothing short of drastic changes in the life of the poor would lead to a much-sought-after urban peace. Violence plaguing cities was rooted in structures of oppression and the political failures of a federal government unwilling or unable to grasp the full extent of the nation's racial and economic crisis.
"I propose," read King's telegram, "specifically the creation of a national agency that shall provide a job to every person who needs work."
Johnson never replied to King, but the president did listen carefully to J. Edgar Hoover's fresh allegations, which falsely claimed King knew of plans to burn down parts of Chicago. Stokely Carmichael, at the beginning of a 5-month global tour, discussed the uprisings from Cuba as the start of an organized revolution. "We are preparing groups of urban guerrillas for our defense in the cities," he said, a statement that made King's efforts to direct the national conversation away from fears of racial rebellion more difficult. In effect, King both led and followed the revolutionary zeitgeist that captured the imagination of late 1960s America and much of the world. Amid shifting political alliances and public sentiment, King now openly cultivated aspects of Black pride. "Black is Beautiful" posters were proudly displayed at the SCLC's August convention in Atlanta, where King decried the negative associations with the word black in the English dictionary in a manner reminiscent of Malcolm X, noting,
"They even tell us a white lie is better than a black one."
In these instances, King and Malcolm found common ground in repudiating all forms of denigration against black humanity. King's call for massive civil disobedience echoed aspects of the type of nonviolent disruption that Malcolm approvingly spoke of during his criticism of the March on Washington. Malcolm had praised the calls by civil rights militants for a march on the White House and Congress that would paralyze the nation's capital. Now King, in effect, sought to organize the kind of nonviolent upheaval that Malcolm X had once endorsed. King was growing depressed over the widespread violence erupting in black neighborhoods during the summer. "People expect me to have answers," he confided in Coretta, "and I don't have any answers." The behavior of major civil rights leaders, such as Roy Wilkins, who seemed more eager to release statements denouncing the riots than condemning their root causes, deeply disappointed him. In a conversation with Stanley Levison, King called the NAACP leader a lost cause.
"He has no integrity or philosophy, and it's just a hopeless case," reasoned King.
He also despaired over the increasingly apocalyptic rhetoric of a younger generation of black radicals, including new SNCC chairman H. Rapp Brown, who had replaced Stokely Carmichael in the spring. With his southern drawl and penchant for headline-grabbing quips, "Violence is as American as cherry pie," Brown emerged in Carmichael's absence that summer as perhaps the most widely quoted and reviled black power activist. Frequently arrested after his speeches, which authorities linked to violence, Brown's abilities as a speaker outran his effectiveness as an organizer.
"I think nonviolence has to be stepped up to a larger scale, to be escalated so its impact would be greater than violence," King told an advisor.
In early August 1967, King roamed Cleveland's Hue neighborhood, where he preached nonviolence at the exact site of urban rioting 1 year earlier. Reporters covering the visit marveled at his charisma and the power of his oratory, yet interpreted his inability to attract large crowds in the area as a sign of his diminished appeal in the North. "He displayed all the attributes of a great leader," observed one journalist, "except followers." But King could still extract political concessions, including from Cleveland-based Seal Test Food Company, which agreed to hire 50 black workers that month after a successful boycott organized by the SCLC's Operation Breadbasket. During an August 13th appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, King discussed his plans to confront war, racism, and poverty during a mean season of discontent in American politics and society.
"The tragedy," is that we are today engaged in two wars, and we are losing both, King explained, highlighting the connections between the war on poverty and the Vietnam War that major political leaders stubbornly ignored. We are losing the war in Vietnam morally and politically, he said.
On Tuesday, August 15th, at the SCLC annual convention at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, King put his more radical views into action, announcing plans for nonviolent civil disobedience massive enough to paralyze cities in pursuit of major federal action. He defined the urban rebellions raging across the land as proof that inequality will now be resisted to the death. He called for a Hungry People's demonstration at the Department of Labor and an organization of unemployed black youth. Major cities would be targeted for school boycotts, factory sit-ins, and a wide range of protests.
Mass civil disobedience can use rage as a constructive and creative force, King insisted.
Neither President Johnson nor Congress exhibited a willingness to seek fundamentals beyond police measures. The movement's ultimate goal would be to drive the nation to a guaranteed annual income, he explained to some 500 cheering delegates. King offered his most comprehensive and radical definition of black citizenship, one that viewed racial and economic justice as inseparable and castigated war as the enemy of both. King now planned to mobilize large, multiracial groups of the dispossessed to descend on Washington in order to compel elected officials into passing radical political legislation. The Poor People's Campaign pivoted on King's understanding of the systemic nature of political oppression. He joined Black Power activists, most notably welfare rights organizers and the Black Panthers, to highlight the widening gulf between political rhetoric and America's worsening reality for the poor. The FBI and the White House noticed too, mounting efforts to damage King by publicly linking him to Carmichael. But King's heart longed for a rapprochement with Black radicals, especially on the subject of peace. He did more than align with Black Power activists on Vietnam. He had amplified their structural critique of racial injustice and economic inequality. King had grown despondent over violence in Detroit. He confessed feelings of hopelessness to aides over FBI wiretaps.
There were dark days before, but this is the darkest, he lamented.
Newark and Detroit embodied the limits of the Great Society, the pervasive nature of racial violence, and the systemic oppression that Malcolm X had once raged against and that King now confronted in public speeches and private deliberations. The Poor People's Campaign would leverage the power of the poor through strategic political alliances with whites, Native Americans, Latino farm workers, and black sharecroppers, who King dreamed would descend on Washington and unleash demonstrations in numbers too large to ignore. Blacks living in the basement of the Great Society demanded more than political reform. They required nonviolent political revolution capable of fundamentally transforming America. King now confronted the American political establishment in uncompromising terms that recalled Malcolm X's assault against racial injustice.
The tragic truth is that Congress, more than the American people, is now running wild with racism, King said, using some of the most pointed language of his career.
He envisioned protests that were less aimed at hearts and minds than based on power that could be leveraged with organized, disciplined, nonviolent political soldiers. After forming such an army, he said,
"We must devise the tactics not to beg Congress for favors, but to create a situation in which they deem it wise and prudent to act with responsibility and decency."
The press interpreted King's speech as a major threat to democratic order. Headlines in the New York Times, "Dr. King planning protests to dislocate large cities," and the Washington Post, "King calls for massive protests," sounded like warnings to a riot-weary public. King made bold plans with the painful awareness that he lacked the organizational and financial resources to implement such an ambitious agenda. He sought to merge Black Power's far-reaching structural critique of inequality and racism with the nonviolent civil disobedience that characterized the peak social and political effectiveness of civil rights struggles. He hoped to compel the President and Congress to approve massive spending at the very moment that a projected deficit of almost $30 billion found Lyndon Johnson supporting an income tax surcharge of 10%. King delayed providing specifics of his new organizing thrust until he met with SCLC staff, some of whom listened with a combination of awe at his ambition and dismay at the scant resources available to implement his aggressive objectives. Not everyone on the left applauded King's evolution. King's appearance on the last day of August at Chicago's National Conference for New Politics was a case in point. The conference featured almost 3,000 representatives from 372 politically progressive groups that came together after 2 years of planning. Conference delegates held a wide range of opinions about King, from deep admiration that included pleas for him to run for president in 1968, to militant denunciations, especially from youthful black nationalists, that he was an Uncle Tom. Hecklers booed King for lacking the political sophistication to understand that nonviolence could no longer redeem American society. King's relationship with the strain of black power advocating revolutionary violence remained star-crossed. While Stokely Carmichael respected King based on shared experiences in the heat of the Southern civil rights struggle, a new generation of black militants accorded him no such deference. King recounted his difficulties to Stanley Levison, recorded by an FBI phone wiretap, the next day.
"The black nationalists gave me trouble," said King. "They kept interrupting me, kept yelling things at me."
As frustrating as his disputes with sectarian black and white radicals could be, there still remained a segment of them who could identify with King's evolving politics. The Second Coming of Martin Luther King, published in the August 1967 issue of Harper's, portrayed the former Time Man of the Year and Nobel Peace Prize recipient as a revolutionary who sounded like a nonviolent Malcolm X. Reporter David Halberstam spent 10 days with King, shuttling through airports, press conferences, and numerous meetings with black preachers, civil rights activists, and local people from Cleveland, Ohio to Berkeley, California. King openly seethed at the hypocrisy of white big city mayors, damning me now and calling me an extremist, who only 3 years earlier gave me the key to the city and said I was the greatest man of the century. 3 years now measured the distance of lifetimes.
"I think you've got to have a reconstruction of the entire society," King told Halberstam. "A revolution of values."
For King, this meant radical black citizenship that comprised a living wage, federally guaranteed income, decent and racially integrated housing and public schools, and a wholesale reconsideration of American foreign and domestic policy. It meant leveraging America's financial might on behalf of the poor, ending racism, and obliterating poverty and injustice through guaranteed economic benefits for all, especially those left out of an era of national prosperity. The very man booed in certain quarters as insufficiently radical now candidly admitted that most Americans are unconscious racists. King confronted the nation's unconscious racism in bold, at times belligerent, strokes at the American Psychological Association meeting in Washington on Friday, September 1st. There, he eloquently articulated the need for radical black citizenship to frequent applause. His speech on the role of the behavioral scientist in the civil rights movement plumbed the state of contemporary American race relations in language reminiscent of Malcolm X's scalding critique of white supremacy.
"White America needs to understand that it is poisoned to its soul by racism, and the understanding needs to be carefully documented and consequently more difficult to reject," proclaimed King.
He told an audience of scholars, academics, and researchers that the tragic presence of racial injustice meant that
"we find ourselves psychologically and socially imprisoned."
He spoke in clarifying new ways about the depth and breadth of white racism. He decried white America for expressing horror at the Negro himself instead of the conditions that scarred black life. The more he talked, the more King sounded like Malcolm. He argued that whites seemed insistent on keeping the walls of segregation intact amid urban rebellions that were rooted in efforts, however misguided, to transform the nation.
The white majority, unprepared and unwilling to accept radical structural change, is resisting and producing chaos, while complaining that if there were no chaos, orderly change would come, he said.
King characterized the years between the Montgomery bus boycott and the passage of the Voting Rights Act as an era of grand illusions, where the entire nation underestimated the power of black rage and white racism. He called the riots a distorted form of social protest, meant to awaken the nation into radical action to eradicate racial injustice. He considered urban revolts the direct byproduct of white policymakers who perpetuate unemployment, ignorance,